I'll use my outside voice so it doesn't pick up. Hi, everybody. I'm Emily Ramshaw. I'm the editor of the Texas Tribune, which is a politics and policy news organization based here in Austin. And I have the great honor today of introducing Anne-Marie Slaughter, who is one of my personal workplace heroes, and she has some incredible things to tell you all about today. First, a quick introduction. When Slaughter's 2012 Atlantic article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, first ran, it immediately went viral, sparking a firestorm of debate. Within 4 days, it had become the most read article in the history of the magazine. Slaughter wrote that piece after leaving the State Department, where she was the first female director of policy planning, and returning to Princeton, where she'd previously been the dean of the Woodrow Wilson School. She did it to play a more active daily role in the lives of her teenage sons, and hopefully her husband, too. The Atlantic article and Slaughter's subsequent book, Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family, have made her a leading voice in the discussion on work-life balance and on women's ambitions. In this session, I hope Slaughter, now the president and CEO of the New America think tank, will burst the bubble on all the half-truths women hear about having it all and teach us what it will take to get true gender equality both at work and at home. So please join me in welcoming Anne-Marie to the stage here.
Thank you.
So this is a particularly timely conversation for me because as I sit here with you, I run a 24-hour news operation and I'm 7 months pregnant with my first kid. So I was hoping you could tell me why I can't have it all because I thought I could.
Well, that dives right into it.
Yeah. So
the first thing to say is let's just stop talking about having it all. I mean, the one thing that I got very clearly after the article. So in the book, I explained that the title of the article was not my choice. I went back and forth with The Atlantic. I did want us to call it Why Women Can't Have It All, ... Because my point was, here are the things we still need to do so that women can have families and work at the same time. That's what I wanted. The Atlantic thought that that was too much like the end of men, so they pushed back, because they had published The End of Men. So they pushed back, and I compromised on still, because I thought people will read Why Women Still Can't Have It All, and they'll think this is about the changes that I want to make. Many people read it as, this is Anne-Marie Slaughter, she says women can't have it all, that's how I'm now introduced. That is not fun, but more importantly, people wrote to me, and I never understood that the whole have-it-all frame was not a feminist term. It came from Helen Gurley Brown, who was the editor of Cosmopolitan, who wrote a book with that title. And lots of feminists let me know that. But more importantly, it's inevitably a selfish frame. And it immediately sidetracks the conversation. You immediately get to, in the first place, people said to me, rightly, you don't think you have it all, you have a great job, you have a great family, like, what's the problem? But equally, it's, you know, people say, well, wait a minute, you know, we've got millions of Americans who are hanging on by their fingernails, 40 million American women who are in poverty or on the brink. This is not the time to talk about having it all. So, first thing, let's get rid of the frame. Let's talk about equality. That is what this is about, right? And I don't like balance either, because balance is a luxury, right? Equality is a necessity. That's what we talk about. So to your question, you absolutely can have work you care about and a family that you love and have time to care for if you need to have a conversation with your husband now, not later, about not just about, okay, will you be an equal parent, but will you be really as involved with this child as I am? And that means from day one. That means taking paternity leave if he can, doing everything you do, and will he defer a promotion if you get one? Or will he move for you if that's what's necessary? And you will do for him. But what happens is you have the conversation about, will you support my career? And everybody says, yes, of course. And then it gets tough, right? Because it's not always 50-50. You're not going to get a promotion, and then he gets 5 years, and then he gets one. That's not how it works. Things come at different times, and people have to make trade-offs. And right now, it's all of us who make the trade-offs. And that is why 50% of us start out, and, you know, 5 to 10 to 15% of us make it to the top. because when caregiving hits, we're still the ones who are the primary caregivers, even if we're breadwinners. And that's the part that's got to be equal.
Well, you list in your book, which is very, very well done, three of what you call these half-truths that women share. The first, that women can have it all if they are just committed enough to their careers. The second, that they can have it all if they're just married to the right person. The third, they can have it all if they just sequence it right. Why are these half-truths and not real truths?
So the first one is the lean-in half-truth. And before I go any further, I want to say, in the book, I make absolutely clear, no matter what you read, that I take my hat off to Sheryl Sandberg. That, you know, lean-in is doing very important work. I'm a CEO. I have had three women come and ask me for raises, and I know that all of them had just read lean-in. And, you know, I say in the book, when that happens, I don't always give them the raises, but I say, you know, it was right to ask, right? And so I tip my hat to Sheryl Sandberg. This is not either or. This is both and. But so the answer to the question, yes, it's important to lean in. Yes, it's important to take your seat at the table and raise your hand. I say in the book that my husband taught me how to act like a man, and I know how to do a lot of what she talks about, and I'm all for it. But even with that, I had every advantage, right? I had a really supportive spouse, I had a great job, I had money, and I hit a tipping point. And my point, you know, many of us hit tipping points, and you can't predict it, right? You can have a child with special needs. You can have a child like mine who hit a really rocky adolescence. And frankly, as teenagers go, there's a lot worse, right? Mine, this was not the worst thing that could happen, but he was making really bad choices. And when they're toddlers, you can pick them up and comfort them. When they're teenagers, A, they won't talk to you when you want to talk to them, right? I mean, that's part of the problem was he didn't want to talk to anybody. And you kind of have to be there, and you have to be there when they need you, and you don't know if it's going to work out. But my point is, there's so many ways you can hit a tipping point. Your marriage can break up. This is my second marriage, and if I didn't have kids my first marriage, but had I, that could have, you know, been something. Or you can rely on extended family for care, and then you have to move, or they have to move. So my point is, you cannot. It's just not that simple. You can want it as much as you possibly want it, but life is unpredictable, and you have to prepare for the idea that something's gonna happen and you're not gonna be able to make it work, and what are you gonna do then? And the second point, I do have a fabulous husband, although let me be clear, you know, there's plenty of, at the end of my book, I say, you know, I dedicate to my husband, we're two strong personalities and a lot of pulling and tugging, and my kids keep saying they're gonna write the Mommy Dearest article that explains what, you know, parenting in the Slaughter-Moravchik household was really like. I mean, there's plenty of pushing and tugging, but again, you know, your marriage may not hold up. Your husband may get a career, you know, have opportunities that both of you say, well, you got to take these, you know, we need the income. It's not enough. That's why I say it's a half-truth, but it's not enough. And sequencing, would that it were true. If I could wave a wand, I would say there is plenty of time for all of us to have good jobs, to have time to care for our kids and our parents, because that's just as important, or a sick spouse or a disabled family member, any of the people who need care. And then there's time to go hard when we're ready to go hard again. And I think, you know, there's a huge pool of women who are around 50 or older who took time out, who now want to get back in. It's an enormous talent pool. We don't have the workforce that understands how to tap that. So my point is, sequencing again is often not up to you, and you got to plan for the idea that it might not be.
I want to talk about something that was a big takeaway for me from your book, and that was this idea of how we value caregiving as a society. So, you know, I increasingly see young women in my generation who go on to get incredible degrees from high-powered universities and then drop out of the workforce to be stay-at-home parents. But maybe the problem is not, you know, sort of the way that we are looking at these women and their choices. The problem is how we as a society are valuing caregiving, you know, as a profession, as a life's calling. I mean, talk to me a little bit about that message in your book.
Yeah. That's the biggest difference between the book and the article. And I say I couldn't have written this book 3 years ago because I just didn't believe what I now say. And I spent, you know, 3 years responding to all the emails I got and reading the commentary online, at least as much as I could handle it. There were days I sort of said, I really don't need to read horrible things about myself all day. I'm going to stop. But talking to audiences like this one and looking at my own family, and one of the things that changed the most for me was that I was raised, you know, as a girl in the 60s and early 70s in Charlottesville, Virginia, to believe that I wanted to be like my dad, not my mom, right? That my dad was a lawyer, my mom was a homemaker. Clearly, you know, I wanted to be a professional woman. And I don't regret that. And one of the things I found out was that my dad raised me to have a career because he had been representing women as a lawyer whose husbands had left them after they'd put their husbands through school and raised the kids, were in their early 50s, their husbands left them. This is the first big wave of divorces, and they were high and dry with no means to support themselves. So my father raised me to have a career. I always thought it was more because of his ambition, but it was really that he was determined that I would never be in that position as a father. But I would have said, you know, my father's a lawyer, and if you'd asked me about my mother, I'd have said, well, she's a professional artist, and she is, and she's fabulous, and I'd have told you she has paintings and collections across the country, and, you know, she's been painting for 40 years. I'd have told you all of that. I wouldn't have said she's a homemaker. And that's exactly the devaluing of care, because now I look at my mother and my father, and they're both in their 80s, and I think it's great. He's a lawyer, she's an artist, how wonderful. And I think both of them, and particularly my mother, created this amazing family. And we have problems like every other family. We're not perfect by a long shot, but she raised three successful children who are strong and have contributed to the economy and to society in different ways. She created a support structure. Without that family, I can't be here. I can't do what I do. They're my foundation, right? It's not that it's a tug of war. Family enables me to be the person I am. That investment, you know, if in the corporate world, we call it the investment in human capital, right? But as a society, that's the most important work we do. You know, honestly, as a foreign policy person, as a policy person generally, investing in children for the first 5 years, that first 5 years of your child's life, you will not just be teaching him or her whatever he or she knows, you'll be shaping his or her brain. You'll be determining what that child learns for the rest of his or her life. I'm not sure there is more important work than that. And caring for those who cared for us, I was raised to do the right thing. I was raised that you have that obligation when your parents need you. You have to care for them. So we don't value it. And what I realized was, wait a minute, we say men and women are equal, but the work that women traditionally did is not equal to the work that men traditionally did. Care is down here. Competition, work that earns an income, is up here. And it's not that I want us all to go be caregivers and give up our professions. I think everybody needs both, wants both, but honestly, they are equally valuable. And a society that sees that is a far healthier and better society.
We've had some big headlines in the last 6 months that are sort of, in theory, pro-working mom, right? We have Twitter offering free FedEx breast milk delivery for nursing moms on business trips. We have people like Yahoo's Marissa Meyer saying, you know, she's offering $500 stipends to new parents, but she's going to come back to work after having twins immediately. We have companies offering to pay for moms to bring their nannies and infants along on business trips. Are these steps in the right direction that are pro-women, or are these steps that just wed us even further to our jobs? I mean, talk about the workplace a little bit.
This is a hard one. So, I mean, it's hard because, you know, to make change, you have to have a vision of what you want, right? So I'm laying out a vision of the world we want, or at least I think many of us should want, but you also have to live in the world you're in. And so it has to be that back and forth. So I have two reactions. One is, look, it is perfectly possible to have a society in which, you know, everybody gets 6 weeks to 3 months of maternity and paternity leave. If everybody gets that, then you've got 3 months and your spouse has 3 months. And it can be, you know, 6 weeks where you're out completely and another six or another couple of months where you sort of work from home and work your way back in. There are many ways to do it. So there are plenty of ways to do this so that you don't have to be FedExing breast milk across the country. That said, I do think, you know, I often thought, given the things that men deduct as business expenses, when my kids were young, if I could have taken a house, you know, a nanny, somebody else, anybody who was also going to help, you know, to help me take care of my child, it would have been a whole lot easier. I mean, there were definitely things I could have done if I could have taken somebody with me, and I thought, this is just because women don't run the world that this doesn't count as some kind of expense. So I think it's valuable to acknowledge the reality, but that can't be where we want to go. Right? We want to go to a place, again, where there is room and time to enjoy your child. I mean, it's fabulous. It's really fabulous. You know, we think about it as it's all about work and we got to fit in life around the edges. You know, for me, being a mom has been just as important as anything else I've done, and I'm also much better at what I do because I'm a mom. And I write about in the book about how giving care and investing in others is just what we do as managers. And it's the same thing. You support your people, you guide them, you discipline them if need be, but you also empower them. You let them do what they need to do. That's what being a good parent's about, you know, the investing and the letting go. So that's not the world we want to get to, but I can't fault companies that are trying to help women stay in the workforce.
You and Sheryl Sandberg have sort of been lumped into this category that the New York Times calls white-collar workplace feminism.
That's the nice version.
Yeah, right. I only chose the nice ones, yeah.
Right, I was going to say, much worse than that.
But, you know, let's talk for a few minutes about the women who don't have that luxury, who don't have the option to make these choices, who are working $9 an hour retail jobs or single parents and are at risk of losing their profession, you know, when their kids are stuck home with the flu. How do we address this on a far broader scale than, you know, women like us who are sort of at the top of their careers?
Who have the ability to sit in rooms like these.
Right, exactly.
So that's, again, you know, when I wrote the Atlantic article, I knew I was writing for an affluent audience. I was writing for the readership of the Atlantic, which is not a mass market publication. So I absolutely knew, and I said, you know, I am an affluent woman. I am an educated woman. I am writing for women who have had similar experiences. And indeed, if you go all the way back to Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, that was always for almost entirely white, suburban, affluent women. And women of color said from the beginning, this is not my reality, right? I am not sitting at home raising my children bored. I am often taking care of other people's children. So this has been a tension that's been there in the second wave of feminism from the very beginning. In the last 3 years, I've realized that when we talk about advancing women, and this is a women's conference, and we are women in this room, when we focus on women, we end up focusing on women at the top because that's what we can count, right? You know, you look at how many women are in the Fortune 500. That's the easiest metric anybody can come up with. And when you say 30, you say we've got a long way to go. Because it should be 250 or something in that neighborhood, right? I mean, that's, or we look at, you know, how many women in any profession, but that means we're talking about the top. And what I realized is it's actually what I call in the book an unlovely symmetry. There are too few women at the top and way too many women at the bottom, right? The majority of minimum wage workers are women. Two-thirds of shift workers are women. The poorest members of our society are overwhelmingly women. They are single moms who are trying to be breadwinners and caregivers both. And I have statistics that motherhood is the single biggest, motherhood is the single biggest predictor of poverty in old age. The most women, people most likely to declare bankruptcy are women who've just had a divorce. Right? When middle-class women who suddenly get divorced and can't make it because they don't have two incomes anymore and they may be getting alimony, but they're still supporting their kids. So what I realized is if you just talk about focusing on women, you are not taking account of the condition of all women. And we have to. Right? That's what it's got to be about. Politically, it's got to be about that. You're not going to get where you want to go focusing on a narrow slice of largely white women. So that's one reason I focus on care. For one thing, many of those women at the bottom are caregivers, right? They're paid caregivers, and they're not paid very much, both for children, but also for elders.
And I have to tell you, as I age, and I'm the height of the baby boom, so as I get older, the baby boom turns into an elder boom, I'm thinking a lot about who's going to care for me. And, you know, I hope my sons are going to be part of it, but I don't have any illusions that they're going to be there around the clock. And so I think about that. You know, valuing care doesn't just mean valuing the care that we may give as we are slowing down or working differently to do that. It also means valuing the caring professions, everything from teaching to active caregiving. As I said, we actually need people who are trained and certified and well compensated. That's a whole market. You know, this isn't just a losing proposition, that's a market. But it also, when you do that, it leads you to things like paid family leave, maternity and paternity leave, high quality childcare that is affordable, quality elder care that is affordable. So it focuses you on a set of policies that address all women. And I really do think it's one of the sort of most important calls of the book, is we need to go back to some more of the early feminism that saw this as a revolution for all women, and frankly also for women of color as well as white women, for sort of the intersections of different classes of women.
I want to talk for a minute about husbands, and you you seem to have gotten a pretty good one. But you know, how do women in
second
general,
time around?
How do women raise the status of their husbands from support staff to full time caregiver or full time lead parent?
So my husband just wrote an article, and we were talking about saying why I put my wife's career first. Also in The Atlantic, it happens to be the family franchise at the moment. But so he said, you know, he never expected to. And my husband is an ambitious guy. You know, I knew I was a woman who needed a smart guy and a guy who I knew was my equal, right? And who was not going, you know, I'm a strong personality and I need a strong personality back. But so it's not like we got married and, you know, he said, oh, great, I'll take care of the kids. That's not my husband. What he said was, you know, as our careers evolved, I got the bigger jobs. Now, part of that is I earned more money, and he thought that was a great thing. His view is he married really well, right? And, you know, that's frankly my son's view, is like, why is that a problem? If you marry somebody who makes more money than you, it's certainly not a problem for us. Why should it be a problem for them? It's not emasculating. I know, that's the big thing. Like, who wears the pants in the family? Well, he does, you know? I wear skirts. But we went back and forth, and what he says in this article is, I got the bigger job. As I got bigger jobs, I had to start traveling. I, of course, went to Washington. We knew he would be lead parent then, but even after I came back, I'd been a dean, I'm now running an organization. Somebody has to be at home. It's not that they can't have a job, of course not, but they have to be flexible, right? Caregiving is unpredictable. It's the definition of it. You know, the kid gets sick, the school calls. That wonderful moment that just happened to me 2 weeks ago where my 16-year-old said, I got a history project. This is, of course, 6 o'clock Sunday night. We've been home all weekend. I have a history project. When's it due? Tomorrow. How long have you known about it? 2 weeks. What does it need? Oh, poster board and magic markers. And, you know, we are going to Staples at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night, right? Somebody has to be there. And those are just, you know, the mini crises, not the big ones. And so Andy realized that it was going to be better for our kids. For him, he had to be there. It was going to be better for our marriage. I really, you know, this was what I needed. It was clear that, you know, this is, if you reverse it and you're supporting the man, somebody's got to be at home, you're supporting him, he was at home, he was supporting me. But this is the kicker. He said it was much better for him. He has a relationship with our sons that is so much better than his father had with him. There's just no comparison. His father was never there. And he wanted to be there. And now we're in this situation where when we were together, our kids text him. And then I text back them and say, what's the matter with me? You know, my phone was open. Like, I'm your mom. Why didn't you text me? But, you know, and we are competitive at times. But really, I look at that and I think, of course a man wants that. We all love being needed. We all love that sense that we have invested in others and given them and allowed them to flourish. And that they need us. That's part of what's so great about being a mom, right? You're needed, you're valued. And so men need that too. And I think what we have to recognize, what I say is, those men who are willing to do it are really strong guys. they are mold breakers. They are the guys who are willing to challenge the conventional definition of being a man, just like the women who are 10 years older than I am, because I graduated in 1980. So the women who graduated in 1970, they're the pioneers. I would not be sitting here but for those women. And they were the women who were called, to say they were called masculine is the nicest possible way of putting all the nasty things they were called, because they were seen as breaking the image of femininity. And 35 years later, we can look at that, and we're 45, and say, no, you know, I could be a CEO and like shoes and like nice clothes and be as feminine as you want, but I can also be a powerful woman. And we need to get to a place where a man can say, you know, I am the lead parent. He may run your house like a sports camp. I'm not saying he's gonna parent like you do. He's gonna parent differently, but he can be a strong, secure man who is just as masculine as I'm, and the way you want a man to be masculine, but he is just as competent at home as he is in the office.
One of the most interesting facets of your book for me was the research on same-sex couples and you know what that can teach us about, you know, traditional roles in the household and who chooses to be the lead parent versus not. Can you talk a little bit about that?
And that actually was, and I was talking to an audience about 3 years ago, and a woman, I was just giving a talk about women at work, and this woman comes up to me afterwards and she said, you know, my wife and I have to divide all this up and we have no default role. Right, there's, because we may think we've escaped gender roles, but of course we haven't. When you're talking to a man, you know, hundreds of years of socialization say you are the caregiver and he is the breadwinner, and you can also be the breadwinner, but he's not going to be the caregiver. But a single-sex couple, two women or two men, there's no default. They're two women or two men. So the question is, who makes the most money? Who is more committed to their career? Who has the more flexible career? That's a really big one. Who's got the best boss? That's a, you know, and the best company policies. And who wants to be more engaged with the kids, right? There are people who really enjoy that. Andy is frankly better than I am. He plays games with them. I'm not a big game player. He's a better disciplinarian than I am. You know, he'll sit there for hours watching our younger son play the piano and, you know, telling him to do it again and getting yelled at. I don't like any of that. I'm not very, I mean, that's just not what I'm best at as a parent. Those are the questions we need to ask. And so I say, same-sex couples actually give us a way of thinking about dividing up labor that should be true for all couples, that it's not an issue of are you a man or are you a woman.
You know, when I think about sort of the trajectory of a woman's career, if I think about stepping off right now when I have a baby, I start to feel this immense sense of panic,
yes.
Right? Like, you know, what happens? Am I going to be able to get back on the ladder again? You talk not about a ladder, but about interval training over the course of a woman's career. And I love that concept, and I was hoping you could sort of explain it a little bit more.
That's another one, as I said, you know, a lot of this really did come to me over 3 years, and so I'm working out. And I, you know, there's a little program on the Stairmaster or whatever I was on that said intervals. And of course, I realized, you know, that's how athletes get into peak position, peak condition, right? They go really hard and then they slow down. And then they go really hard and they slow down again. And I realized in my own career, that's what I've done. I mean, I spent 4 years getting tenure. I didn't have kids, and there was no question about how hard I had to work. And I was on a very short tenure track, most are longer. And then I spent 4 years trying to have children. And I was working, but I was mostly focused on trying to have children. And then I became a dean, and I went really hard for 5 years. I'd never run anything, and I'm suddenly running a school of 100 people, you know, 300 students, 70 faculty, 100 staff, and boy, did I have a lot to learn. And so I went really hard. And then I took a sabbatical for a year, which as a professor you can do. Then I went into government, then I came out and took 2 years, much slower pace. So I tell people, let's think about our careers, women and men, in terms of those periods where you're going to be able to lean in and those periods where you're really going to need to work differently. And to give you sort of just one example, if you're in a, you know, if you're in any client-facing business, you know, like, you know, banking, for instance, if you're client-facing, that's where you really are on call a lot of the time. You know, you got to be there. But those jobs typically also have corporate positions that are more predictable, right? They're not easy, but they're more predictable. So, I mean, you're in the news business, if you are really, if your life depends on the news, that is not predictable. Mm-hmm. That was me at the State Department, right? I couldn't say to Egypt, hold the revolution. I'll be back on Monday. You know, no problem. It doesn't work that way. The world happens and you respond, and that is a job where somebody else has got to be a lead parent. You're not going to be able to do both. But you can think about it in terms of, okay, when I'm going to be, you know, when my kids are young or my parents are old or whatever it's going to be, I can think about moving to this slower paced job, or I can move part time but keep my hand in. I say don't drop out if you can avoid it. Defer, but stay in some way. And you can also think about, well, okay, so maybe I am going to go part time, or maybe I'm going to stop working, but then I'm going to volunteer and I'm going to hone my public speaking skills. I'm going to learn how to fundraise. I'm going to do management in a small nonprofit, which is hard, and you do learn management. So you can think about these sort of ways of working that are going slow and then working hard again. What we do have to do, and this is where when I talk to employers, we've got to make our workplaces ready to take you back when you're ready, or to let you ramp up when you're ready, whenever you're ready. It's not, you know, you missed it, so you're no longer considered. You're stigmatized for having taken a flexible position. But it's perfectly possible to plan for careers that way. And frankly, millennials are going to have so many different jobs that this is, you know, sort of natural. They're going to be changing jobs anyway, and they can think about intense jobs, and then they can think about slower jobs.
You write that the next phase of the women's movement is really a men's movement. What does that mean, and how do we help nudge them in the right direction?
So this one is where I really hope that women, I do not expect the primary audience for this book to be men. I mean, I'm realistic enough to know that. I insisted that men be in the title because this book is aimed at men as much as at women. But what I expect is that women will read it and hand it to their husbands or their partners or what, because a large part, so the half-truths, I talk about the half-truth, a child needs her mother. A child does need her mother and her father equally. It is not about some special mother love. It is about spending time with your child and investing time with your child. There are plenty of single fathers out there, and they raise great kids. And I have had plenty of women come up to me and say, my father was the lead parent. You know, dads can do it just as well as we do. They do it differently, and we have to get used to that. I talk about the fact a man's job is to provide. Well, that's in the Bible. Right? And we do, that's deeply ingrained. But my point is, why is providing cash rather than care? Right? I'm a provider. I provide both. And a man can provide the care that a family needs just as much as the cash that a family needs. So what do we do with men? The first point, as I said, I hope they will read this too. I do think we need to encourage men, and this is happening with millennial men, to talk about what they want. Right? One guy wrote to me, this was an eye-opener, and he said, you think I have it all? I don't. I want a very different balance. But I am socialized to be the breadwinner. I don't have any choices. I want a different balance, but I can't get it. And then he said, you're probably thinking, this is one guy in a million. He's writing me, and he's anticipating my reaction to what he said. And he's right. I was reading thinking, okay, you know, you're a great guy, but that's not what most men want. And then he said, this, you know, in the 50s and 60s, men thought women didn't want to work. This is what men said about women. Women don't want to leave the house. Women love their role. Women don't want to compete. Women don't want to be in this hard, nasty work world. That was exactly the world I grew up in, where men assumed they knew what we wanted. Well, lo and behold, we have more choices. Turns out many of us do want to have both. We don't want to give up family, but we absolutely want to pursue our own goals. And Virginia Woolf said, we want a room of our own. We may want that room in a house full of people we love, but we want a room of our own. So we can't presume we know what men want. And if we give men the space to say what they want and still value them as men, and that's up to us, right? They'll value what we value. They want us. That is kind of one of the basic rules of human nature. A lot of them have written Andy to say, you know, I actually do want a different balance. I do want to have more time with my family. It is, when men are on their deathbeds, their first biggest regret is I didn't lead the life I wanted to lead. I led the life society expected me to lead. That means they didn't go off and write a novel. They didn't go off and go sailing. They didn't do lots of things they wanted to do. They did what society wanted. And the second biggest regret is I didn't spend enough time with my family. So that means when they age, they look back and know, as many of us know, you know, investing in your children, in your spouse, in your siblings, in your parents, that's some of the best stuff life has to offer. So let's ask men what they want, and let's give them the space to say what they really want without worrying that we'll think they're less of a man.
Well, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to open it up for Q&A because I'm sure there will be a lot from this group. You can line up at the microphones, and we're just going to ask that you make sure you have questions, not speeches, prepared so we can get through as many as possible. So feel free to start lining up. But, you know, I'm a political reporter by trade, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. You write a lot about how we need more women in executive leadership, more women, you know, up and down the political spectrum. Obviously, I'm assuming you're a big Hillary Clinton fan, but would a Hillary or Carly Fiorina presidency be better for the United States than another man in that slot?
Well, I do say, and I believe this, Republican and Democrat, we are better off with more women in office. We really are. And there, in fact, I think a lot of those women who are 50 plus and wanting to get back in, I encourage a lot of them to run for office. And I cite research in my book that says, when you have a critical mass of women and you need 20, 30, 40%, when you get to 40%, not only do those women make very different choices about how we spend our budgets and they invest a lot more in education and care issues, but when you get to 40%, men change what they say. Because it's like middle school. Right? Boys think a lot of things, but surrounded by other boys, they say very few things. You put them in an audience where they feel more confident, and a lot of men think we should be making different choices too. So I'm all for women. The only reason I hesitated on Carly is that, and I know her, I respect her. I've worked with her a little bit, not like I've worked with Hillary Clinton, but I was on a panel, a commission with her. The first woman often outmans the man. Right? I mean, Maggie Thatcher outmanned the men. So did Golda Meir, so did Indira Gandhi. You know, Hillary Clinton, I often say, when she was Secretary of State, she was the third woman Secretary of State, and she's really tough, and everybody knows it. So she made women a huge foreign policy issue. But Madeleine Albright didn't dare do that. And I don't fault her. If I'd been first woman Secretary of State, I'd have been tougher than tough. So I just don't know. Carly, so far, is basically, it's Marco Rubio who's put forward a plan for paid family leave. You know, and that's great. It's not Carly Fiorina. So in general, I'd say absolutely on that particular question, it might be that one of the men would be more pro-care issues than she would be.
Great. Yes, ma'am.
So it seems like when we talk about this, we talk a lot about managing our own careers and planning for our own families. But do you have any recommendations for those of us who might already be leaders or managers of others? Like, how do we make it easier for those who work underneath us to create change or to make their lives easier?
It's a great question. And there's a chapter in the book called The Perfect Workplace, which is, you know, like, if you could really wave a wand, what would you do? There are a number of things. The biggest thing I think we can do is manage for results, right? Just stop with the FaceTime. It's not that people don't ever have to be in the office. They do. And I run an organization where, you know, if nobody's in the office, you lose a lot. But it's really about the work. If somebody gets the work that you need done on time and of the quality you need it, then if that person, you know, had to go home early and do it late or come in late and spend some time at home, you know, depending what they needed, or work from home one day a week, that's fine. It's got to be about the results. And I tell people who are asking you to say, I could do a better job for you if you let me do the following things. And then you as a manager have to say, okay, let's try it. Not, all right, automatically fine, but you think you can do a better job if you've got more room to accommodate either self-care or care for others. I'm going to be open to that. I think that's probably the biggest thing we can do. And the second is walk your own talk. Right? I mean, I take time off. I believe I actually New America has 6 weeks of paid time off, but you can only roll two of those over every year because I want you to take four. because you will be a better worker if you take 4 weeks off. I know that. I've seen it. I've read the literature. I've done all the research, and I do it myself. So those are the two things I'd advise you to do.
My name is Trish Morrison, and I run an organization called MomCom Life, MomComLife.com, and we do a conference every year, and we talk about this all day long. So November 7th, MomCom Life, this is what we are really passionate about, motherhood and the power of motherhood. And we believe that we are the ones who are going to change the world. It's moms once we get that going. So now, with the help of people who are already there, and my question for you is, how do we, I believe fully that it's the systems, our systems and the way we work and the way we say that we're supposed to be working are so entrenched, and this is how it is, and that's, you know, what is it that will start to change our systems, and do you see a change already happening?
I do. And this actually fits perfectly with the last question. Thank you. So I should have said also, I'm on the board of a new organization called openwork.org. And you can go online. It's got examples of tons of different companies, from construction to telework to anything else, that have actually made big changes. But here's the point. It's not called work family or balance or anything else. It's called open work, like OpenGov and open source and open data. And it's about reinventing the workplace. And that's the frame, right? We have a 21st century workforce and a mid-50s workplace, right, where we still think June Cleaver is at home. You know, it really is. It hasn't changed all that much since Leave It to Beaver or Mad Men. So what we say is, whoa, we're in a digital economy. We are reinventing everything. We need to be in reinventing the workplace. And we need to, the way Open Work says it, is to overcome the poverty of imagination about the ways we can work and work efficiently and effectively. So I do think moms are unbelievably efficient, right? I look at people who are there till 10 at night, and I say, you are a bad time manager, because somebody else got that same amount of work done in 6 hours, right, not 10. And that's the way I think about it. And so we need to reinvent the workplace so people are getting the best work done most efficiently, you know, in ways that serve the whole organization. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So we've been talking a lot about, like, how to change, like, in the workplace, the perception in men and stuff. But I have found that it has been women that have often been kind of more of the block. So I am obviously pregnant, and I am expecting my second. During my first, I worked for a company that was mostly women, and I found that it was the women that got most annoyed when I scheduled break to go pump. Or, you know, when I was traveling with three other women, I had to schedule with our client meetings, like, time to go pump, and I had extra time through security because I had breast milk and stuff like that. And I found that it was the women on my team, not the men, that were against me. And then at my new company, we do not have a maternity leave policy, which is unbelievable at this day and age. And had I planned on having a second, I probably would have been more looked into that more, as I did with before my first pregnancy. And our HR director is actually a woman, and I have tried to bring this up, and the response was, well, there's the Family Medical Leave Act. And my response was, great, so you can tell me I can take 12 weeks. I'm going to lose hundreds of thousands of dollars, like, in medical and, like, in salary, in income, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars in income that I obviously need, or I wouldn't be working in the first place. Yeah. So how do you combat the women that are the issue versus the men? Because I have found personally that the men have been more accommodating. I mean, when you tell a man client, hey, we can't schedule now because I need to take 20 minutes to pump, they do not even question it.
Yep. They're not touching that subject.
They don't even want to have a discussion about it. They are like, that's fine, we'll move the meeting. Whereas women, well, hem and haw. So,
and you write a lot about this in your book.
I do. Yep. I do. And honestly, I have to say, I get this question all the time, and it makes me sad. And part of it is women who came up without any accommodation at all, and they are, I did it, so I'm going to make you do it, and frankly, you'll be better off because you'll be tougher, right? You know, I'm telling you, this is what it takes. And my response to that is that's like doctors, you know, who worked 36 hours and never got any sleep, and that's the way they think interns should be trained today, when in fact we now know that's really not good for patients, right? You actually do need doctors who've had enough sleep to recognize you, right? And so part of it is, okay, I know that's the way you came up, and we're grateful that you did it that way, but you did that so we could have a better workplace for everybody, not so that we could duplicate what you went through. But then more immediately, your best hope is senior men in your organization, and I hope you have some, who have daughters. Right? They are our secret weapon, because the guys who have daughters who are in your position suddenly see the world differently. They suddenly see that their star child, who they invested in, who they think is a superstar, is not able to do what she needs to do because of these policies. And I have found often that they are more receptive to making those changes than often the women who came up with them. And that's where, and I would also urge you to talk to other men who've got families who need that for their wives, so that it's not you, the pregnant woman, who's insisting on this, it's parents. You know, at PIMCO, PIMCO has PIMCO parents, and I write about that. It's parents who are saying, you know, this company needs maternity and paternity leave. It will not attract the best people. It will not retain the best people unless we have that. And it's going to lose the investment they've made. It could lose. It could lose the obvious investment they made in you, and they hired you, so they value you. And now they're not doing what they need to do to allow you to keep working there.
Thank you so much. I loved your article and your husband's articles as well. I think one of the things we're missing is sharing examples of different type of people in our society. So for example, my boyfriend and I were watching the debate the other day, and we're looking at Hillary, and he said, wow, I hope one day you can be like her and I can watch and cheer behind, you know? So I don't think all the men want to be macho and are macho, etc. So you have different kind of men. The other point I would like to bring up is that I appreciate the point on care, and it's really important, but I think it's also important to talk about women's talents. Yes. And promote them from the beginning. So one thing I heard recently, for example, or I heard about it before, but I saw more data on, is that women often select professions or education that puts them at a disadvantaged positions. So for example, many women go into marketing, sorry, not to offend any marketer here, but starting salaries are around $30,000. I studied computer science. The average starting salary for my major was something like $70,000 back in 10 years ago or so. So, and we had 10% women.
Right.
I didn't end up going into computer science, I ended up going into banking at the end, but I was always surprised how women were self-selecting out of these professions. So I think it's important to have a conversation about care, but also have a conversation about how do you better position yourself in life, and how do you maintain yourself, your identity, your talents, and not just a mom role, which is also very important, but it's not our only identity.
So this is an important question, and I want to be very clear about what I'm saying. So in the first instance, absolutely. You know, this is where lean in and unfinished business are both and. They're not either or. And I absolutely think, you know, women should go for it in any profession they want. I think these two things are more connected than you recognize, though, because I think one reason women choose those professions is many women are thinking, I want to have children, and I'm not going to be the frontline banker, or I'm not going to be the person in tech who has no time. So that part of it is, if you make clear that you can be an investment banker or a computer scientist, and you can also have room as a woman, but also as a man, to have family, you'll find more women who say, okay, that's the trade-off I want. So that's part of it. The second is, again, care is not the assumption that women are moms and we're the caregivers. Care is the assumption that everybody has a part of them. I have probably less of it than many, because I'm not as maternal as many, that, you know, it gets real value and rewards from investing in others. And you can do that as a manager just as much as you can do that as a mom. But part of it is to say, if you want to be the frontline profession, you want to be that banker, the top banker, you need a lead parent at home. So if you're going to do that, and I'm all for it, then you need somebody at home supporting you the way the men in your office need somebody at home supporting them. And part of the argument is you can't get to the top without that same support system, and that's going to have to, or maybe you marry another woman, but you're going to have to change the roles for men. That's part of the argument. The care is an argument that says men have got to do it to support women. Women have got to be able to do it and be valued for it. And professions have got to understand that we make room for it, or we're just not using our talents. Women, female talent, just as much as men.
All right, we have time just for one more. Helena.
I work at the local community college, and I work with a lot of women who are coming to us for training to go back into the workforce.
Yes.
And the one thing I find is when we're working on the resumes or their interviewing skills, they're always trying to cover up the fact that they've taken out this chunk of time to be at home for whatever the case may be. How do we change as a society that dialogue so it's not seen as something as a shameful time of your life?
Exactly.
What can we be doing?
So part of that, absolutely. You should put caregiving on your resume. You should say, I raised three children, or I took care of my father, or I, whatever it was, you should put it on your resume, and you should be prepared to talk about what you got out of it. And part of the book really does say, and I got this part of the book from a book by a man about the value of care, and he was not writing about work and family. He's a philosopher who wrote in 1970. Had nothing, it's really a man saying, this is what care teaches you, this is how you grow when you give care, and those skills are transferable, but more importantly, those are just valuable. You know, when I hire people, I look for people of character. You know, one guy wrote to me and said that his boss bragged that he worked 80 hours a week when his wife was dying of cancer. I would never hire somebody like that. I'd never hire somebody like that. I wouldn't hire somebody who said, yeah, my kid really needs me, but I'm here. I'd say that's not the kind of people I want. I want people who are, you know, feel their obligations to the people they brought into this world, who do the right thing by those they love, and I know those people are going to do the right thing by me. You know, they're professionals. So part of it, I would own it and I would argue for it. But here's the other thing. We should all be arguing for companies to institute returnships, right? Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs both have, you know, return to work programs, returnships like internships. And any company can do that to help people get back in. And the point has to be, this is an enormous talent pool and we are wasting it. These are all the women. Yesterday I was at the Most Powerful Women's Conference in Washington. And I said to every woman there, it's great that you're here. Now think about the women who sat on the right or the left of you in business school who's no longer here. Was she any less talented? No. She was just as ambitious as you were. She was just as educated as you were. She started out her career like you did, and she hit something in her life that meant she couldn't keep going for a while. But isn't she somebody you'd want to hire now if you could get her back in and get her back trained? I would. I wouldn't take her without, you know, just plain, but I would absolutely say, and companies can do that. They can take returnships. So those are, I would own it and talk about it and value it, but I would also say companies need to do their part. So let me say one last thing, because we're out of time. So I think you asked about men. We've been talking about men. I know there's a lot of skepticism when I talk about this, because it's like, oh my God, no, we're not going to change men. So let's just remember, I grew up in a world in which my mother put out little cups of cigarettes when she gave a dinner party. That's what she did. You put out little vases of cigarettes so everybody could smoke afterwards. That's what everybody did. I grew up in a world that was still basically Jim Crow. I mean, it was about 8 years past Jim Crow in Virginia. And I grew up in a world in which the idea of same-sex marriage couldn't even have been articulated. Right? You couldn't even talk about a gay man. Homosexuality was non-existent except for the interior decorator. Right? And that's really the world that I grew up in. And we live in a completely different world on those three issues now. And, you know, with same-sex marriage, that's been just 5 years. And no, we haven't changed everybody's minds. But this kind of change is completely possible. And we would not be sitting here if we had not revolutionized society's idea of what a woman is and what she can do. And we can do this for men. It's up to us. It's up to them. It is the unfinished business of the women's movement, because if we don't change their roles, we will end up the breadwinners, and the caregivers will be doing two jobs. They do one. We will never be equal. And the very last thing I will say is my sister-in-law read this book. Of course, she's my sister-in-law. My brother read this book, of course. He's my brother. Like, you can't be my brother and not read this book. And she called me last night and she said, you know what? Brian has been so much better. They have four kids. They have four kids in four different schools, and she works part-time, and they're both lawyers. And she said, he's been just so much better after he read your book.
There you go.
Case closed.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah.